We made this.
And welcome to We Buy Records Summer Roadshow live from Worthing. We're joined by Bruno Brooks, Liz Kershaw, live music from the Pasadenas, Brother Beyond and Sunita. No, not really.
Beyond pulled out.
Did they?
Yeah, I'm really sorry, Paul.
I'm here as ever with my lovely co-host, Mr. Tim Scullion.
Hi.
And this special summer episode, we are joined by legendary musician, composer, remixer, producer, Mr. Paul Kendall. Hi, Paul.
Hello there.
Thank you very much for joining
us. Very nice
us.
To see you guys.
It's great to be here down on the coast in Worthing with you. We're going to crack on. We've got some great questions from listeners coming up later. But first of all, we thought we'd get a little overview of how you got into music, how you came to join Mute. And I know you're working at a bank.
There was a period in my life where I was working at a bank. But before that, I think it's probably not actually that I got into music. I got into sound and noise really early on. Two significant moments was my Uncle Jim got hold of a tape recorder and an old reel-to-reel. And he recorded my voice and then he played it back to me at half speed. And I was just absolutely blown away.
Would you have been then?
I was probably 5 or 6.
Brilliant.
But it's obviously significant because I can remember that moment. And at that particular time, and I thought, well, I really want a tape recorder. I want to play like and make noise like that. And then shortly after that, I think I heard Telstar by the Tornadoes, which is like a big, that was the space age. You know, I was born in 54. So, you know, when Sputnik went into orbit was, I think, 59, 60, 61, something like that. So I was a young kid growing up and space was a big important thing. And this Telstar track by the Tornadoes had a particularly weird organ sound in it. It was produced by this guy called Joe Meek, who was a legendary producer in the 60s. And that sort of tweaked my ear. So between the transposition of my voice and this sort of weird otherworldly sound, I got into sound and just coincidentally, I would listen to the radio all the time, listen to pirate radio, but there emerged what was called psychedelic music when I was like 11, 12 years old. And so I really got into that because that was all weird sounds, Hendrix with a wah-wah.
So you were into that when you were 11, 12, 13?
Yeah. Yeah, I was quite advanced.
But how lucky you were in at that time.
Well, there was no internet, so it was pirate radio. There was no television programs that would play any sort of music of that ilk. It was all pirate radio, and then there was a thing called Radio Geronimo, Radio Luxembourg, occasional programs on that. But it was all, and that was all down to having a little transistor radio, which was like my big ally at that moment in time.
Well, were any of your friends listening to that stuff?
Yeah, I guess there was a few because we, at the age of sort of 13, we formed a band called Obscenity's Children.
Wow.
Which was just
That's a
me.
Heavy name.
It was me singing and playing harmonica and descant recorder, and my friend Steve playing electric guitar through a tiny little amplifier. And we did two gigs at Ruth's Garage in Bexley Heath when we were about 14. And then
Mute is going to be reissuing those this year.
Yeah.
The garage tape.
Deluxe heavyweight double vinyl.
Fortunately, it doesn't exist. There are some very embarrassing things that exist, but that's not one of them. I did start really early. And by the time I was 15 and 16, I was getting into things like Soft Machine, much more experimental rock stuff. In fact, I gave up on rock music pretty much after I saw Led Zeppelin play live. I saw one of their first gigs in London at the Albert Hall.
So Paul, Led Zeppelin were...
It was the end of an era for me, because I'd been into sort of British electric blues, Peter Green, 10 years after, and people like that. But Led Zeppelin took it and amplified it, you know, both sound-wise and spectacle-wise, greater than anybody. And it lost the soul for me. So do you mean
that gig left you cold?
Yeah, it did. I felt as though it had become artifice. It was people going through the motions rather than maybe it was because I'd been exposed to a lot of it at a very early age. So and I was getting really tired of it.
Did you veer towards like krautrock and space rock and jazz rock, or did you veer towards experimental?
No, I went experimental. I went completely into, I went into experimental, freeform jazz, the British freeform jazz scene, in sort of 71, 72. I was listening to sort of Evan Parker, Derek Bailey, all those sort of people.
And you were still, were you still a teenager?
I was 17, yeah, I was still, yeah. No, I know.
So it, you had that musical journey that people sometimes sort of take 20 years to go through?
Yeah.
Like, you know, sort of pop to harder pop to weirder pop to not really pop at all to freeform, strange noodling. And it took five or six years.
Yeah, it was, I've still got the book, my discography of when I bought each record, and you can see, because I didn't have any money, I was at school, there'd be a big sort of wodge of things around Christmas where, you know, my sort of relatives would give me money, and I went out and bought loads of free jazz records and sold a load of old blues records. You know, it was a sort of give and take thing, but it forged me. I had quite a broad, you know, appreciation of music and sound, which was, as it turned out, really fortunate when I come to meet Daniel Miller, who ran Mute Records later.
So when did you meet him?
Well, that wasn't until I was 29.
There's a whole kind of 10-year...
Yeah, yeah. What happened after that was I left school to go to university to read mathematics at York. And the reason I went to York was because they, at the time, they had the best electronic music studio in the country. And a couple of the people that were working up there were very, very well respected electronic music composers. And I wanted some of that, even though I was a math student. And I did this crazy thing just before I went up to York. I was at a free jazz concert, and I went up to one of the musicians there and said, "Look, I've got this idea for a piece of music, right? I just need to get this tape together." I said, "But I've got nothing. I haven't got a synthesizer, I haven't got anything at all. And I'm going to university and I want to take this tape up there because I've got this great idea." And this bloke must have thought I was a lunatic. But he gave me this guy's number in Blackheath. And I went round to see him and I said, "Barry Guy sent me. He says you could help me realise this piece of electronic music." And he was a lovely bloke. I mean, I was a crazy 17, 18-year-old kid, you know. And he sat down with me, took afternoons and put together, using the old VCS3 synthesizer, British synthesizer, straight onto a Revox tape recorder, he put down 15 minutes of music for me, which I'd sort of directed him. "I want that sort of sound, I want that sound." And he did that for me. So as soon as I went up to York, I went into the music department with my tape. I said, "Look, I'm a math student, right? But I really like electronic music, and I've done this tape, and what I want to do is I've got this piece where there's a mime artist, there's six dancers, there's a free jazz thing, and this tape, it's all going off, right? And this is it." And the guy...
I could see that going either way, depending on that person's...
I knew York would be, you know...
Because they're either going to embrace you, or they're just going to not...
No, they embraced me, but at arm's length, because when push came to shove, and I said, "Look, I'm really hopeless at maths, and I don't know anything about music," I said,
"For the two
but I really like electronic music. Is there any possibility that I can transfer courses?" And they said, "Oh, sure, it'd be all right." But they really didn't realise that I really didn't know anything about music. And they made me sit this oral examination one morning where there was a guy sitting at the piano playing a note. And then he played another note and you had to tell him what the other note was. And I was like, got a clue, mate, sorry. So
you blagged it, basically.
Well, no, I didn't. I didn't blag it because they didn't let me in.
Oh.
So I didn't blag anything. But they did mount my piece. I mean, my piece was performed
with
in front
the mime
of a,
artist and the
yeah,
dancers.
Yeah, the mime artist I'm still friends with. There was, I think, four women dancers, one of which I was sort of still in touch with. The guy who played the piano on it in the free jazz group is a guy called Steve Beresford, who's a really very well known in the free jazz circle still, and he's a teacher, I think, at the University of Westminster. Him, and then there was another guy called Jan Steele playing saxophone, who made an album on Eno's Obscure Records back in the day.
Fantastic.
I mean, it was before any of these people were like very well known, and they contributed to my little bit of, you know, whatever, As Your Father, you know. But it was great. I mean, I was 18, 19. I thought you could do anything. But then reality hit, and I got kicked out of the university because I wasn't doing any work, you know. I was more into playing in the music studio because they allowed me to work in the studio, so I got to use a synthesizer and a tape recorder for the first time in my life.
How long did you last at... Was it York University?
York. I was there for two terms.
Okay, that's not
too
bad.
And the third term, I returned and was a gardener on the campus.
Brilliant.
Just so you could get access to the music department.
And the music department still continued to allow me to use their facilities after I'd cut their lawn for them. Whilst I was doing the gardening, I was wearing red platform boots and a pair of Brutus dungarees. The reason I got these was because a friend of mine from school was an amazing character. He ended up working with people like Nicholas Rogue and people like that. But the BBC offered to let him make a documentary about the youth of today. Alex was 17, 18 when the BBC agreed to do this. And what he said is, one of the things was going to be, he was going to film me playing freeform saxophone in the Holland Park Orangery, right? And so it was all set up. There I was, playing freeform saxophone, my little yellow bubble hat, going, really horrendous noise, dogs barking. It was, you know, all kicking off. And I got paid by the BBC. I got paid something like 15 quid or something, you know, which was amazing in those days. So I bought a pair of red platform boots and a pair of Brutus dungarees.
Beautiful.
Which I later wore at the...
Did that get broadcast?
No. They lost the tape. They can't believe they lost the tape. It was a thing called The Hollow Moment. And the guy that was a photographer on it was a guy called Phil Mehew, who ended up working on loads of the Bond films, I'm sure. He was quite a big sort of, you know, well-known.
See, he's connected to everything.
I know.
It's all... You're all there. You're this, you're like...
terrifying.
Like, if you look at old photographs from 200 years ago, Paul Kendall will be in the background somewhere.
Always the footnote. Always the footnote. Yeah. Falling between the floorboards. So after getting kicked out of York, I was living just outside London, so I managed to get a job at Barclays Bank, which was, you know, a bit of a come down from all the exciting things, except that I was in Piccadilly Circus. I was in Piccadilly Circus, you know, in the middle of everything happening, and, you know, the bank wasn't in my vein, so I would work until 4:30.
Clock off,
change. I would actually change. Obviously,
into
only
your
person,
red platforms.
Yeah, I would change from the suit to the jeans in the toilet of the bank and then go out into the world. And then, you know, you're in the middle of Soho and you go out, see concerts, you go to the theatre, you go to the cinema. And you know, in that period of my life, I had money for the first time because I'd got a regular job. I was slap bang in the middle of London. I was still into sort of a lot of the free jazz, sort of experimental electronic music. But then in 76, punk started happening. And, you know, and it was just, that was great because it was like, it kicked away all the sort of dinosaur aspects of people like Led Zeppelin that I'd rejected, but gave me that sort of the visceral sort of power that only, well, you know, intense, loud rock music and intense, loud free jazz give me. You know,
and then
that,
before you know it, you've then gone from punk to post-punk, which actually then brings in the free jazz, the strange funk,
to an extent,
electronic
noises. Yeah. you know, the cycles, they go round, they go round, don't they? But no, it was great. I mean, I'm really fortunate to have been, you know, in Piccadilly Circus at that time. You know, it was just really happening. So yeah, I got into punk. Wire were my sort of all-time favourite punk band, and were later to sort of figure in my life, which was weird. And what was even weirder is at that time, they were all rehearsing around sort of Covent Garden way, and that's where this rehearsal studio I had. So there was plenty of opportunities for our paths to cross, but they didn't until much later. But so yeah, so that was that. And we did, then I started doing this this little rehearsal studio in Covent Garden, which we built in a basement, which was quite a good experience.
But so then were you drawn back into more structured music then?
Yeah, I think so. I think I was what I was drawn into, I think I'd realised, is that I wasn't actually going to be much of a performer. I think my performance days were on, you know, free jazz saxophone, bit of vocals here and there, you know, had probably gone past their sell-by date, you know. And I really wanted to start developing playing with tape recorders again, you know, and maybe using synthesizers. Or I was never really into synths, and it's a bit of an anomaly working for some, you know, for Mute for so long. I was more interested in manipulation of sound, sound that exists already. Music concrete has always been my sort of starting point for sound. So anyway, we had this studio with me and a couple of mates. So I sort of learnt the rudimentary things about placing microphones in front of drummers and stuff like that, and making sure, you know, the ashtrays were emptied and stuff like that. Was great, you know. That was it was a necessary thing.
And this would have been what, 70?
80. That this was sort of 80, 81, 82.
Can you imagine now, though, the real estate in Covent Garden is so out, every it's, single square yeah, inch is, yeah, has been gobbled up by something corporate. So for you to have a recording space in Covent Garden, is it sounds incredible.
Well, it was fortunate because one of the guys involved was an architect, and the architectural practice that he worked for rented the whole building. So it was the basement they weren't using. So if they could get a few, you know, £100 a month or something from these sort of three hippies working in the basement, you know, then great. And that's what they did, and that's what we did, and it was good. I mean, it was bloody hard work, you know, putting together a studio. And the equipment was phenomenally expensive in those days. We had Revox tape recorder, two track machines. So what we'd have to do is we'd record the bass and drums on one machine, we'd play it back, and then on a second machine that would be played back, plus the guitar would go on that level. So what you're actually doing is you're building it, building blocks. You're mixing as you go along, because once you've committed it to tape, you can't change it. You destroy the take, or you keep the take. So you're layering up all the time. And but that was good. That was I enjoyed that because I was having to use my ears for the first time in hearing what the end product was trying to sound like. You
did,
know,
it, did of, any bands come through that studio that we may have heard of?
No.
So it was a really successful studio.
Well, there were a few bands. No, there were a few bands around the 80s. There was a band called the White Brothers, two white guys. And they used to do really political little raps, and they were great. You're black, you're red, you're no good in bed, and you're busted, you're not to be trusted. It was like these, and I was like, never heard this before, because it hadn't actually come across from America yet, you know. And I did do a little search about them, and they did, you know, it wasn't me sort of remember, you know, weird memory sort of thing, but they, if you search up the White Brothers somewhere on the internet, you'll find an interview with one of the members.
And so they did release stuff.
That they must have done, yeah, but not what
that
we
must
did.
Have been strange hearing rap music for the first time, and especially in that environment, in a studio, not in, on, a small, sort of in the background on MTV or something. That would have been
MTV didn't exist then.
That's what I mean. Yeah, to have that as your first exposure to rap music must have been amazing.
Happening literally right in front of you.
What was happening at the time was the Young Ones. That puts it into its historical perspective, and all the craziness of the Young Ones and the anarchy, you know, and the sort of political sort of posturing. We at the time we had a we had a Marxist rock and roll band, which is the one that released a record, you know, a Dry Rib record. But yeah, it was good. Golden oldies in the 1980s.
So how did you transition from studio and the bank to, I guess, did you meeting Daniel or working at Mute? Did it come that you met Daniel and then joined Mute, or you joined Mute and met Daniel?
No, it came from Dry Rib, the group that I was in. They came down to record at the studio, and their lead singer was this American woman called Joni. And she just come over from America, and she was working in Covent Garden, and she wanted to sing. She had quite a good voice and everything. And so she joined this band, and I eventually ended up joining the band, and Joni and I eventually ended up getting married. So January 1981, we got married. And then in 1983, I was at this party. Me and Joni were at this party somewhere, or maybe it was 82. Was a really old girlfriend of mine. This lovely, lovely person, Frances. And we're at her party, and there was this really eccentric character there wearing Union Jack socks, which looked completely incongruous at that time.
Yeah, I wouldn't trust somebody wearing Union Jack socks.
But he was a harmless fellow. Anyway,
I was in a restaurant, and Roger Daltrey was at the table next to us, and he was wearing Union Jack socks. And
you don't trust him. No, that's
instant. Right,
okay. And he's an Arsenal supporter. And it embarrasses me to say it, you know. So anyway, this fella there was. I got talking to him, and it turned out he was a musician, and he was a friend of Francis. This woman that I knew had invited us to a party, and his band that he was in were looking for woman's backing vocalist, and he'd asked Frances if she'd do it, and she said, oh no, but actually Paul's partner, she's a singer, Joni, she might be interested. And Joni was interested, and she went for an audition. The audition was at Blackwing Studios in sort of near London Bridge, which at the time had a small recording studio but was ostensibly a rehearsal studio. And the band was Fad Gadget, who was the first band that was signed, really, to Mute Records. So Joni joined Fad, along with two other women. There was three backing singers. Joni also played electric viola. Gradually, Joni managed to get the other two women kicked out. That's what she says. I don't think it's really true. No, it wasn't true. So Joni stayed with the band for about 3 years, I suppose. She did the first thing she did was a single called I Discover Love. Then they went off to Hansa to record Gag album. And shortly after that, I think she toured quite a lot. And then it all stopped. I can't remember why, but it did.
But that was that first connection between you and that particular world of artists and creatives and stuff.
Yeah. He did have a really odd career. I mean, when he changed from Fad Gadget to Frank Tovey, and he started doing all that diddly D music. Not going to lie, I wasn't a fan.
No, but before that, he did Luxury, which was a bit of a weird sort of almost. I don't know, it's weird. I look a lot at the Fad Gadget fan pages on Facebook, because I became very close to Frank, a lovely man, you know, and a lot of the music was... I actually would probably prefer his early stuff when he was just him, you know. Although there's certain things in Gag that I really like. There's some interesting stuff. And then, you know, I did some interesting stuff with him later on, slightly... warped folk music, sort of country folk music. It's okay, but I think
not
like,
your
you know,
cup of tea. I wouldn't have thought
it was or... just a strange one. Luxury is probably one of my favourite things he ever did. And there's if you ever get a chance to go on YouTube, there's a real famous clip of him at I think it's a festival in Germany. Have you seen it?
Yeah. It's all kicking off.
It properly kicks off. He starts smashing up the instruments.
That's Simo on keyboards there. Because it's Eric. Actually, that's really strange, because the guy playing guitar is actually Eric Radcliffe, who ran Blackwing Studios upstairs at Eric. And Eric never did any gigs, but he did that. I think there's this that particular German festival. He went out with them, and Simo's on keyboards, and Simo, they're just pulling this place apart. And he tells a good story. Simo, if you ever get an opportunity to talk to Simo, he's got some amazing tales.
You've got to see that clip. It is. We'll put a link in the show notes because it's absolute genius.
It is funny. Yeah. And it. I think it all ended in tears.
Oh yeah.
So I'd met Daniel sort of socially through Frank Fad Gadget, and I remember there was this really lovely vegetarian Indian restaurant around the back of Hamway Street, just off Oxford Street. And we were there, and I had a copy of this electronic music album by a guy called Dennis Smalley that I wanted to give to Daniel because I knew Daniel was into electronic music. And Dennis Smalley was one of the reasons I went to York, because he was doing his doctorate at the time, and I still think he's one of the greatest electronic music composers, you know, in the last 50 years, and it's only been going for 50 years. Well, no, 60, 70 years. But so I gave this record to Daniel. It was like my calling card to say, it might be Fad Gadget, but I really like this sort of stuff. You know, it's a bit snobbish, but anyway, I gave it to him, and he got in touch with me. Said, "This is just extraordinary record." I said, "Yeah, I know. It's really high quality stuff." And then what happened was, sadly, my mum died and left me. She worked as a telephonist most of her life, and her pension fund was split between me and my dad. So I got, one day I'm sitting in the bank being miserable, and the next day I've got 16 grand in my pocket. So I think, right, I'm walking out of the bank, you know, and I did. And just at that period of time, they brought out the 16-track Fostex tape recorder, which was the first time a multi-track could be considered affordable. I mean, it was normally you'd be looking at nothing, you know, £15,000-£20,000 for a multi-track machine. This was like £5,000 for 16 tracks, which was, you know, it's still a lot of money in those days. This is 1984, but it was great. You know, and so I got that. I bought a small mixing desk. I bought a drum machine. I bought a DX7, and eventually I bought a
and they're coming back now.
What, the DX7? Mm, they were everywhere. Every episode of Top of the Pops.
But they are that. The value of the DX7 is creeping up, because for a while it wasn't worth an awful lot, and now it's, you know, it's getting there again.
Brian Eno always used to say the DX7 was his favourite synth. He was being a little bit disingenuous there.
But, yeah, I would think so.
Anyway, but so, yeah, I got all this stuff. And in conversation with Daniel around about that time, he said, I'm thinking about setting up a small recording studio for some of my smaller artists on Mute to be able to work and maybe make records from there and whatever. Yeah. I'm thinking about getting the similar sort of equipment that you've got. Would you be interested in sort of coming along and giving me a hand, sort of setting it all up? Brilliant. I said, yeah, fantastic. You know, 6 months previous, I'd handed my notice in at the bank, and it was getting a bit tight, you know, and there was possibility of work. So I did that, and also at the time he was doing a lot of work with Depeche. So he'd go around the world a bit, and me and Simo would take the Synclavier, this huge sort of computer-based sampling keyboard.
The Zappa.
The longest we've ever gone before Depeche Mode gets mentioned on the podcast.
Can I say congratulations? Thank you, Mr. Kendall. Normally, within about sort of 45 seconds of each episode of the podcast, one of us will have mentioned Depeche Mode and or David Bowie. So that was that's at least 20 minutes.
Yep.
So
well done.
Right. I could have started off with Bowie, actually. He was quite important as well.
You've got a Bowie tale?
Well, the big concert, the free concert he did in Bromley, all my mates went to it, because I lived in Welling in Kent, and Bromley's quite close. And a load of my mates went, because we knew about Bowie. You know, we'd heard.
So when would this have been?
72, 71, 72.
So pre-megafame Bowie.
Oh, yeah, yeah. This was the legendary Beckenham Bromley free concert thing. I don't know
still would have been living there.
Yeah, no, he was still there. Yeah, no, it was probably him just an acoustic guitar. Yeah. But I couldn't. I was playing football. So there you go. Anyway, and I did meet him later at the Mute Studio.
Oh.
He worked in Worldwide for about 2 weeks on the soundtrack of that computer game that he did.
Yeah, which has never been released as a record. It's been bootlegged. Yeah, so that would have been very late 90s.
Yeah, it would be.
So he recorded, he had sort of in character, he was in the game.
Okay.
And he sang some songs and then also, worked on some instrumental stuff. And there's a lot of it. And I just think it's one of those inevitable record store
day reissues that
we'll
at some point.
This mate of mine, Kev, who was the engineer at Mute, he worked on that. He engineered that. Reed Scrabble was the bloke that was on it. And then Kev went out, was fantastic for Kev. He went out to New York to work on it again out there at the studio.
Wow.
So, but he was sat in the corner of Mute Studio having a We went to the same school, didn't we? Yeah. You don't remember. But we both went to Stockwell Junior Boys School very briefly. He was only there for a little while, but I was there 4 years, 6 years.
Well, so we've done Depeche and Bowie now.
Right, we can end.
We can end there. Yeah,
were you kind of the in-house engineer, master of the studio for a certain tier of Mute artists?
Yeah, the ones that didn't sell.
Well, see, that I didn't want to put it like that.
No, but it was
the hint that you were kind of giving.
That was largely that was fine by me. I mean, if you look at my history of music and what I was interested in, I wasn't interested in ding 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 ding. I was much more interested in
people
like Diamanda Galas, who they signed later, or Wire in their post-punk phase, or the actual pop, or actually one of the, it's quite interesting, what are the records of Mute that I bought before I started working for Mute?
Yeah.
Okay. Warm Leatherette, obviously, because
brilliant.
That had such an incredible impact on everyone.
Yeah, it's amazing.
So I had that. I had a Yazoo record because
but that's just pop Moyo, music, isn't
it? Yeah, but Alison Moyo's voice just, blew me away. And the other one, which sort of a bit later connects up, is The Birthday Party, Nick Cave. Although at that time they were on 4AD, but they got transferred later or whatever. So they were the only artists that I had a real, any interest in, particularly The Birthday Party, I would say. I was much more into The Birthday Party because they were screaming crazy. It was a confrontation.
Man, yeah, and Diamanda Galas, that is challenging vocal music.
The first time I heard her, I had a real problem with voices. It's caused so much happiness and so much grief in my life, is that how people's voices sound and the way they affect me really does affect me deeply, and so if there's a voice that I like, it gets me to the core. And if there's people I know that sometimes their voice, I can't deal with it, man.
Are we all right? Are we okay?
No, you're all right. No, it's just something, I don't know what it is, I don't know why, because I was always into noise, and the voice is not a particularly, it's a mellifluous thing. But Diamanda was just, she was so special.
Did you record with her?
I have recorded with her, yeah.
I did wonder, is it difficult to capture her voice?
Yeah, the dynamic range is just incredible.
What is it, like several microphones or
how? The time I remember more clearly was when we recorded for Recoil. So that was in quite a good environment in Alan's studio. And so there was a close microphone. And because the space sounded quite good, a distant mic to pick up a bit of the room. Then you're recording and you're anticipating when she's going to sort of let rip. I mean, she's a talented artist, so she knows not to scream directly into the mic. She'll move her head away to the side or whatever, just to give you a chance.
That's funny to think that even Diamanda Galas has got the like trad microphone technique of, you know, when you see like Tom Jones going big. Yeah, and it's just funny to think that.
I mean, that's one of the reasons I really liked, what was her name, the poor woman that died?
Amy Winehouse.
Yeah, her mic technique. I saw her just doing a gig in a barn in Ireland in a very small festival, you know, just with a simple short mic and her technique was just fantastic. You know, you love recording that.
The way that Bowie did it on Heroes was, I think, by just having three microphones further away, which is another way to do it.
Of course.
It's because Bowie didn't have the talent that Amy Winehouse has got.
So we're at mute now.
We are. What, do you know what would be really useful is to get a kind of, for you to paint a picture of what your role was as the engineer and the producer. I know... Renegade Soundwave, Sound Clash, Nitzer Ebb Belief. Give us an idea. What was the actual day-to-day mechanics? So the artists have arrived in the studio. You're there. What's the process? And in terms of your involvement?
Well, I mean, on those two particular projects, I was the engineer on the projects. They're both produced by Flood.
Yeah.
So that's beneficial on a number of different levels. One... For me, as a sort of reasonably rookie engineer, you get to learn a lot by working with people like Flood, who've been doing it properly, you know, since they left school, you know, going into a proper studio as a tape op and learning, you know, everything from the engineer, you know, the engineer above you, and then, you know, they pass the information on to the next set of T-boys. I didn't go, you know, as you know, I didn't go through that. I went straight from... you know, recording two-track demos into sort of trying to make records for Mute. You know, I learned a lot over a period of time, so it was okay. But I actually think stuff that I did then was better than what I ended up doing, you know, because I didn't know... there's a lot to be said to being a novice and just experimenting for the sake of experimentation and not being... you know, too influenced about what's going on around you, or, you know, once you start working in the studio, it's very unlikely that you know what's going on around you because you're so focused on what you're doing that the rest of the world really doesn't exist. Quite problematic. That's why I was fortunate because I had 29 years of culture running around my head before I, you know, put myself in a padded cell. And they threw away the key, and then there was the next sort of 15 years locked up, you know. Great experience, but, you know, because I'd had all that experience of lots of other sort of music and stuff beforehand, I think that was quite beneficial. Not to Depeche Mode and Erasure, but maybe to sort of, you know, other people like Alan, you know, Recoil and things like that, because, you know, we have a fairly similar background in music. I think I go out a little bit further than him, you know. But he knows what he's doing and I don't, so that makes it all right.
Because he's a classically trained musician, isn't he?
Yeah, he is, yeah. Yeah, he's... one of his brothers is as well. I mean, but classically trained up to a degree, you know. I mean, that's probably... He was probably classically trained up to the age of 15.
Which a lot of kids are in some instances.
So I don't know what level at that he finished, but... But certainly his command of music and is second to none. You know, I mean, it could have got a degree in music, I'm sure, easily. You know, not that means anything, but that's relevant. But no, he knows what he's doing. So my role in Nitzer Ebb and Renegade was as the engineer. That was the learning from Flood was incredible. It was the early day, also the early days of sampling, and Renegade were completely and utterly constructed from samples. That's why the music's that first album, one of the greatest albums I've ever heard. You know, it was so revolutionary of its time.
We were talking about it earlier, saying it's so far.
Yeah,
I remember listening at the time, and I was like, wow, what is going on here? But it was released in the middle of the dance craze as well. Yeah. And it was aiming at that crowd, but it wasn't delivering quite the music that they wanted, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no.
But the 12 inches of the remixes did, but the album itself was probably way too far ahead of its time.
Yeah. No, there was a very good reason for that. It's because the three members of the band, absolute that covered completely and utterly different areas. Danny Brito was a very good dance DJ. He got the loops and the bass and things like that, and that was it. You base that on that, and then Carl would come in, and Carl was this complete eccentric, and he'd be bringing in stuff which is obvious now, but at the time it wasn't. People like Serge Gainsbourg loops and things like that, or he'd take something from really obscure, you know, things that you know, Seven Brides from Seven Brothers or something, and you just throw it in. And somehow, what you'd do is you'd lay the sample out on the keyboard, and he would play the almost like the sample into the, like playing it at different pitches and things like into the groove that's going on, and start constructing this really weird sort of harmonic sort of thing. And I don't know how he did it, but it made the difference between the sort of workmanlike drums and bass that was you hear a lot in the clubs, and you hear something like this, and it's like, what is going on here? And then you've got this leery sort of singer bloke, you know, who's still being leery, and, you know, he was amazing. He wrote an album of witty. I mean, the lyrics are extraordinary on that album. Unfortunately, he's never, you know, done it again. But that particular album, there's some brilliant lines on it. I don't know where he got them from. I mean, it's pure. I mean, his father used to work in Covent Garden in the flower market. So, you know, it's a little bit woo, a little bit wah.
And he's Gary, got the patter.
And Gary took that tradition. And that album, the lyrics, just read the lyrics. There's a track called Pocket Porn on that. And it is just hilarious. I mean, it's genius. The man's very, very, very talented lyricist.
Are the lyrics on the sleeve?
No, you have to listen to it. Incredible experience for me. The one tragic thing is all the synths that we recorded at Worldwide for the Belief album, I think they redid them all live, actually, in Swan Yard when they mixed it, because the tape noise that we got at Worldwide was too great on the for the quality that they wanted at the end. So they basically recreated the whole of the 24 track again in Swan Yard when they did the mix. Amazing. I mean, that was just crazy stuff.
I've been on the Belief tour. I remember seeing it at, I think it was the Charing Cross Astoria. Holy moly.
They were good then.
They were amazing. Yeah. It was one of the first gigs I'd been to. I was only a teenager, and I'd come up from Hastings to London, and I had no idea what I was walking into, and it just completely blew me away, completely.
Yeah, I think, honestly, of all the groups that I've come across since I sort of became a professional, as it were, in like 84, 85, you know, there are very few groups that I think I would have naturally gravitated towards. But I think Nitzareb, Renegade, Pansonic and Ortec would be the ones that I would have, you know, certainly Pansonic, I would have found them quite early on in Ortec, I'm sure. Maybe not Renegade, it wouldn't have probably been my area, but...
Loop?
Oh, I work with them, though.
No, I know. I'm wondering if... Because that's one thing that is also interesting is if, as it was your job, you can't look at your CV and think, oh, well, that means these are all the acts that he likes. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
For it's fun to wonder which ones which ones you would listen to anyway. Like you were saying, the Mute records you would have bought anyway.
Yeah, some of them, yeah, definitely.
There must be stuff that you worked on that you were thinking, Jesus, this is exactly...
Yeah,
this is my cup of tea, and then obviously ones where you think, yep, get that setting right, fine, make sure that microphone's fine, and then just basically have no interest in what they're doing.
No, I don't think I ever felt like that I didn't have. Maybe later on, as I got older, and then there's certain things that I did actually when I was living in France that I could.
Did you feel a bit more like you were a jobbing?
Yeah, I felt like I was. It was paying the maintenance, you know. That's what it was doing.
But then, as jobs go,
yeah, I'm not. I'm not. I'm not. You know, I yeah, it worked out right as far as I'm concerned. You know, I'm not living in a mansion or anything like that, but I'm, you know, I'm happy.
But you got to work with April March, so, you know, you can't complain.
No, I know.
Was she good to work with?
Oh, she's one of the most sweetest people I've ever met.
No, she's, you were so, you know, over. I'm so glad to hear
you know that. You know what's incredible? You know she drew some
for
of
Ren
and Stimpy.
I do.
Her partner at the time was the guy that did Ren and Stimpy. That was her actual partner, the guy, the original guy. I'm pretty sure, I hope Eleanor, that I'm not saying naughty things, but no, yeah, she...
She had a song on Ren and Stimpy, I think. She had a
quite
song,
possibly,
don't,
yeah.
Don't Whiz on the Electric Fence, yeah. I think was the song that she got into Ren and Stimpy.
Yeah, no, she was...
Because she's criminally underrated.
Yeah, I worked with her first in Mute, actually. We had her at the studio in a mixed quite a bit of one album at Mute. Because that was a weird connection. It was this rather large character, not physically, but in terms of his stature. This guy called Bertrand Bergelat, French guy, who I came across because he joined Liebeck, which was very weird. Liebeck had signed to Mute, and the way Liebeck work is they often work with musicians or engineers to realise their ideas. They're not musicians in themselves, they're conceptualists and
they're more chess players, aren't they?
They're a bit more involved now, I think, than they were in those days. But in the early days they were more like directors and producers rather than performers or anything. So they found this guy in Paris called Bertrand. And he was an amazing musician. He was very much the French touch. He could do all the Gainsbourg stuff. He knew all about people like Nick Drake and stuff like that, and the string arrangement. So incredible musician, absolutely incredible musician. And so obviously I met this guy, Bertrand, and got on really well with him. And he was absolutely eccentric. I mean, he was from the French aristocracy, you know, looked like an aristocrat. He used to play up to it quite a lot, you know. And a lovely man. So I went to see him once I was going to possibly do some work with him on another project in France, and went out to see him. And that's when I met my second wife. He introduced me to her, and then that's cemented my sort of connection to France in a way. That's why I was doing a lot of French mixes in England, and eventually went out and lived in Paris.
When you were doing the day-to-day Mute stuff, were you more interested and excited by the recording process than by the actual acts?
I've had some disastrous sessions in studios, you know, really quite awful.
Because you clashed about what the vision was?
Yeah, because the vision is wrong, you know. And it's,
yeah, okay.
You know, but they're the artists. That's, you know, it's their prerogative to do that.
But isn't it also then slightly your job as the person who actually knows how this stuff works in the recording process to kind of say, that's great guys, but actually if you do it this way it will work better on vocals.
I was never like that though, because really my I hated recording. The idea of recording anything was so tedious, you know. It was just sitting down with it, you know, the line up the tape recorder, 24 track, you line up the tape recorder with tones and things like that. I just want to record. That's why when digital came I thought, God,
really?
Just turn it on and record it. Look, there are plenty of people that have grown up loving recording. The microphone, what microphone? Oh, what preamp, what compressor you're using? I thought, oh, no. And I ended up working with this French engineer who just absolutely adored recording drums. And I just used to look at him. I said, David, I've been doing this for donkeys years. I still hate it. I said, it's evidenced on a lot of records I've made. Unfortunately, the drum sound is crap. I said, I refer you to the Loop album. I said, I refer you to Fade Out. I said, if we'd had, all the guitars sound lovely, they float, and all the bit.
Yeah.
As you listen to the drums, mate, and they are appalling. They are absolutely appalling. And I said, that is my fault. You know, I tried to do something in the mix, and it obviously, I recorded it, and it got it wrong. But
wait,
anyway.
So which bit of the process do you like then?
Mixing. That's all. Once you've got the stuff,
you can have fun assembling it.
Yeah, it's after that, you know, all the pressure's off, and you can just sit and fly out wherever you want to go and
you
experiment.
Create something new that wasn't there in the recording.
Yeah, possibly. Yeah, I mean, it depends on your role. You know, sometimes you know, I can remember when we did the Lieback album that we did at Mute, we were running three studios at once. We were running a rehearsal room, a programming suite, the main studio, and a digital editing suite. We were making...
I thought they were the fucking Beatles.
Well, the crazy thing about it was what they ended up doing was because we had all these different versions, is they had a different version on the vinyl to a different version on the CD to a different version on the cassette, which they released at that time. So that particular album's got three versions, all of which, I'm pretty sure, you know, 75% of it are all different.
We're going to talk about 12-inch singles now and remixes. Funnily enough, this is... I first came across your name. It was a 12-inch single. It was See How It Cuts. It was a B-side to When I Start Counting 12-inch. And it was called the Limited Edition Extended Club Dance Remix Version. And I thought, what the hell?
I'm gonna laugh.
Yeah, and a remix by Paul Kendall, which is a name which I would see again and again and again over the years. I bought that record at a fair in Hastings in Alexandra Park. And I think it was at a Morris Minor and the Majors were performing, and some bloke had a stall with some records on, and that was and I still remember it to this day. That was the first time I saw your name appear, and it'd be many, many, many years till I had never clue what you looked like or anything, because there was no internet back then. You were just a name on a record, and it almost started my kind of love affair with 12-inch singles and remixes. And then we're going to talk about the advent of the sort of 12-inch remix, but we have got a listener question which ties in nicely. Yeah. And it's from someone called Black Celebration. And he wants to know, can you explain how remixes are made? What do you get from the band, the label? How much liberty do you have to be creative? And how much time do you have?
Oof. How long is a piece of string? No, the 12-inch single was obviously a device for selling more records and making your record available for DJs to play in clubs. And so the dance people would know that you had a 7-inch single out. It was an advert for a 7-inch single, primarily. In the early days, it was really difficult to make, slightly tedious to make, because you'd actually have to record every bit you wanted onto tape, onto half-inch or quarter-inch tape. So if you wanted something to play twice, you'd have to record it twice. So you're building up a whole sort of big reel of tape with all these different bits that at a later date you're going to come back and use a razor blade to cut and sellotape them basically back together.
So what arrived at your door then? Let's say in 1987 you were doing a 12-inch mix. This is pre, you know, widespread computer editing. Would you have received a series of separate tapes of, or would you just get the master?
No, you just get what's called the multi-track master.
Okay.
Which in those days was a 2-inch tape with 24 tracks on it.
So you'd
have all their stuff. So you bring that, you bring your 20, well, it'd be 23 tracks up, because track 24 is for the code to run things like automation on the computer and the desk and stuff. So you'd have 23 tracks that you could do whatever you like with, you know. And a lot of people, when they did remixes, would quite often ignore those 23 tracks and just do what they wanted and do it. But, you know, I don't think I ever did that. I would listen to it and then...
I think Aphex Twin was quite famous for handing in his remix. And then a year later, in an interview, he'd be like, oh, yeah, there's not a single note of the Bruce Lars on that one. Yeah.
I mean, that's all changed. Everything's changed since the advent of the affordable computer and music becoming digitized. Everything's changed. You know, we can all do remixes. We can all make albums in our front room now, which, you know, we could never do before.
But is that for good or for ill? For the world of
for
music?
For me, it's like time to close down now, mate. Sorry. I just think, I don't know. I don't know if it's just age and cynicism, but I don't get very excited by lots of the availability of things. In fact, it's the opposite. I find that there's a number of reasons. I have problems with my hearing, which is difficult for a sound engineer to say. So I can't honestly say that if I hear some new music, whether I'm actually hearing the whole picture. So rather than sort of make ill-informed judgments, I don't bother listening to anything reasonably modern. What I do though, and what I have been doing, is re-listening to a lot of the music that I used to and following a line out from there, which normally goes through 84, 85 when I started professionally in music. So it's going back to that old route that I was taking back in those days and filling in the gaps on that sort of thing. So a lot of jazz stuff that I'd, you know, stopped listening to, I started to listen to again, because I feel as though I know the colours of that, so it's not a million miles from what I can imagine, and the high frequencies that I can't hear now are less relevant in that sort of music. And also that because the frequency range of electronic music is infinite, and so it's, there could be like a whole world happening up there in your 10Ks and your things, and I'm just like, yeah, when's it starting, eh?
But you can go back to your Orteca records.
Yeah.
Like, well, I know there's stuff up there, so enjoy this.
It's almost like there's an imprint in your memory of stuff. So when I listen, nothing sounds dull to me. It's not as if, you know, even though there's a considerable hearing loss, and it's like it's suicide for a sound engineer. So, oh, my ears are fucked, you know. So, but it's true, and I think people should face up to those sort of things, you know, because one of the reasons that they are is because of headphones. I was a very early adopter of headphones and early adopter of getting very, very excited by music. And so, you know, blasting my head out with my headphones. And, you know, when I was 14, going to see Led Zeppelin, standing in front of the PA, just sort of idiot dancing, you know, these things affect you. And the arrival of the Sony Walkman, which is where everyone had personal stereos, and you know it's like travelling on a tube, you can hear everyone's hi-hats going like this all over the shop. It's killing your ears, man. And I'm not going to wear hearing aids because they sound awful. I tried one once, awful experience. When the first digital interface with a computer happened, which was around about 1989, about 90, there was this thing called Sound Designer, which was the precursor to Pro Tools, which everyone knows. Sound Designer was, you could record your sound into the computer, you'd see a waveform display of the sound that you're in, and then you could edit that piece of audio, and you could do various little transpositions on it, stretch it, reverse it, change the volume of it. You could really, for the first time, sculpture sound inside a computer. And that completely altered the arrival of the 12-inch and accelerated the 12-inch, because what it meant you could do is you just put one, say, 4-bar section in and then tell the computer to repeat it 8 times. So rather than record it 8 times, which is what you would have to do with the old analog recording onto quarter or half-inch, you could do it immediately in a computer. So, and then if you wanted to reverse that in the middle of it, it could do that, which you know, you would be cutting up with razors and, oh man, did it upside down? I don't know, you know.
Would your sense of timing have to have been excellent when you were doing it the analog tape way?
Yeah. No, you...
Because it literally was just, and then the next one.
Yeah, yeah.
God, for a whole track.
Yeah,
like a 5-minute thing.
Oh yeah, it was a lot of work.
God, so I'm going to listen to some of these again when I'm going to appreciate
exactly
them.
The same thing.
And that is a classic. That one I mentioned, the one with a really long, stupid name.
There was a lot of maths involved, so I was quite sort of, you know, sort of groovy on that one. I like that.
That's where your 2 terms at university came.
Yeah, yeah. Well, yeah, the maths discipline.
Should we get to the bits that the juicy bits? People, about the artists you've worked with and the highs and the lows.
The lows. It's best to start with the lows, I suppose.
Go on.
I can't really remember. The funny low is when I worked with Erasure. You know, in the early days of Erasure, I was actually doing their live sound. Flood did the first few concerts, which I'm sure sounded brilliant. And then they got me in to do about four or five concerts or places. We did a sales conference in the German mountains somewhere.
Living the dream.
I think that might have been quite good, but I don't really remember. It was a bit of a risk because, you know, Vince knows exactly what he wants everything to sound like. And that wasn't really my sort of approach. I was a bit more rock and roll, you know. It's like, oh, the bass on Sexuality, man. Oh, I'm going to turn that up. It's really good, you know. But then it was good experience because, you know, that was before they became massively popular. And, you know, even though Vince was really well known, it was quite a struggle, you know, and Andy wasn't known at all, you know. And so I saw that sort of blossoming, which was great. But the funny thing was we were working, Vince was working up at the studio. Before we moved to the Mute building, we had a temporary studio at the top of the Rough Trade building in King's Cross, which was a great laugh. And Vince was up there working on demos and stuff like that. And I think he'd just been on the Today programme as well, one of those television sort of things around about 6 o'clock, you know, and they'd been up there filming bits and pieces. And he was working on this track and I was listening to it. It sounded really good. And I said, Vince, I said, I think this track's a real winner. So it's one of your best, mate, I think. And he just turned around and looked at me with a withering look, I could say. I said, are you taking a piss? I said, no, I think it's really good. It's an ABBA song. Gimme, gimme, gimme.
Didn't you end up working on that?
Yeah, I did. I remixed it as well, I think. But that was it. That was pretty much the last thing I ever did for Vince. I really don't.
Do you think he was properly knocked?
Well, no, you don't. I just think I showed my complete and utter ABBA ignorance, you know.
Because you spent all that time listening to free jazz in the 70s.
Yeah, I know, yeah.
You should have been listening to ABBA.
I should have done it, but no, I did like ABBA, actually. I remember when Waterloo came out and, you know,
Cheer.
Eurovision Song Contest, I thought it was a cracking track.
And, from a record seller perspective, we often talk on the podcast about the ins and outs of what people want and what they don't want and how and sort of what the value of music as a physical medium and how there's an ebb and flow of things that are more and less popular at any one time, stuff like that. ABBA are very much back in terms of selling as their record selling. So for a long time, ABBA were absolutely a charity shop record band.
Like Paul Young.
And they would be like Paul Young, the god that is Paul Young. He's on the, yeah, I don't know if you know that the graphic of our podcast is a box of records, and
he has a certain penchant for them.
Yes, he does. So yeah, so ABBA, along with I guess the Carpenters, Elton John actually as well, and probably a few others that maybe 10cc, Supertramp. So these are all bands who at one time or another were kind of quid charity shop acts. Yeah. And then they creep back up. And I think a lot of them, there's after enough time passes, credibility ceases to be an issue. And so acts where for a long time they were seen as naff, a generation grows up where they're like, oh, well, my parents liked ABBA. My parents liked Elton John. My parents liked the Carpenters. Yeah, that's oh, great.
That'll do for me.
Yeah, here's a fiver. And there's, you know, Carpenters or ABBA.
Excellent.
And it's just, yeah. But it's
quite, well, it's good, it's for recycling, nice, isn't it?
But part of me really likes when the concept of credibility kind of goes away again.
Yeah, I know. Were you talking about Zig Zig Sputnik recently?
Yes.
Oh, yeah, but in the case of Zig Zig Sputnik.
That's really odd. Was it you that liked them? I thought they were so ephemeral. They just, there and then were gone.
Give it another 10 years,
and they'll be
okay. And then their album will sell.
I saw them in Hastings. I think it was at the Electric Grape. That was maybe why. I didn't get many bands to Hastings, but it wasn't long after that that I saw Nitzer Ebb. So they kind of
yin and yang.
Yeah. So the low of confusing ABBA with Vince's work to the highs of
there's lots of things that are satisfying. I did a remarkable record with a French woman singer, which was when I first started to really go into what I called the screwdriver work with a voice, which was to, you know, really go into, you know, EQing sort of syllables and things like that. Wow. to make everything as clear and as precise as possible. One of the big problems of French popular music, and I did quite a few years out there, is that the French require the voice to be so loud that in some cases I felt that it dominated too much the music. What the French would do is they would slap a compressor on the voice so that they've got like it's like the thing we were talking about mastering, you know, where you take out all the dynamic range. So there basically would be like a band of voice that would then sit on the music. And so it was almost like there was no communication between the vocal line and the music. I didn't like the sound of it myself. I don't like using compressors because they changed the colour. For me, they changed the tonality of the voice. And maybe I want that, but maybe I don't want that. Maybe I want the purity of the voice. And also I like the sort of little artifacts of a voice. You know, when the breath goes out, some of that's quite sexy, let's say it's sensuous, you know, and I want to make the most of those sensuous things, and clicking the mic like I just did with my finger is the sort of thing you don't want, so I cut those out. So I started to get into this sort of crazy obsession with the voice, and there's just a couple of tracks that I did with this woman called Lou, which I think it's absolutely perfect. She's got one of the most fragile voices I've ever heard. And it ended up like it was dancing in my head, just drawing the volume of her voice through a whole sort of strand of a song. And I just think it sounds fantastic, you know. And I used the same technique with a couple of other people. There's a really good British singer called Michael J. Sheehy, who used to be in a band called Dream City Film Club, and he's got another band called Miraculous Mule. He's got an amazing voice, and I did that sort of technique on a couple of his solo records, and it does sound, you know, you listen to it, actually the voice sounds really good on this. And that's what I started to concentrate on more, and now with the sort of hearing loss and stuff like that, I can still work on voices because I can hear the voice, you know, that's still there, it's still in my, you know, and so I like the idea of like really just working on voices. I do it a lot with Olivia's stuff, and she does all the music herself. But it's good for someone outside to come in and micro tune, not tuning, because I'm not into tuning and I don't understand things like that. It's emotion. If it's right, you know, if it sounds right with the music, it's right for me. And that's the, you know, criteria I apply. I'm not a musician. So, yeah, that's what I started doing, and that's only possible with the technology that we've got now. You know,
that leads quite nicely on to a question that we got on Twitter from Richie, who says, "What can be done?" So, talking about compression and voice compression, and looking at the screen and seeing that it's basically just a black bar on the screen with no peaks and troughs. So you must have been in hell during there was a thing called the loudness wars, which I'm sure you know about. When everyone just thought the answer for music is to make it sound louder on the radio or on the TV than the thing that came before or after it. And the best way to do that is to have everything at just 100% compression. And it's horrific. With that in mind, Richie asks, what can be done to educate musicians and producers about the mastering process, as there are currently services online offering automated mastering that can take less time than the track itself?
That's absurd, isn't it? It was always a little bit of a dark art. In those days, it was really necessary for mastering because everything, there was no CD for a start. It was all vinyl. So vinyl is electromagnetic device for getting, you know, sound onto a piece of plastic, and it requires knowledge. It's like you'd have to be an engine, you know, a proper engineer to know that the volume of the sound that you're putting into the lathe that's going to cut this sort of thing on a bit of plastic is at the right level and not going to completely screw up the vinyl. And, you know, you put something on too loud, and then when somebody press it and they put their record on, put the arm on, and suddenly it jumps out of the groove. You know, these things can happen with out of phase bass signals and stuff like that. So there was a knowledge, there was a craft of mastering in when I first started, prior to CDs, the appearance of CDs. It was absolutely necessary because it was a big process. It was then going to go to a pressing plant, and you know, there's a lot of mechanical things involved with the old method of vinyl production. So mastering engineers were essential. When CDs first came in, there was a little bit more flexibility in terms of the mastering because the digital was yes or no. So as long as you didn't go over where you're supposed to go over in terms of volume on the thing, everything would be fine. All the things that you did beneath that were absolutely fine and dandy, didn't matter. And so for a long period of time, you know, CD was seen as a liberation, except certain people thought, well, vinyl actually sounds better than CD. Right, well, I don't, you know, I'm not going to get involved in that, you know, I don't know, you know.
You're on the wrong podcast.
Oh, really? So what happened then was when everyone got their own sort of laptop computer, they had the technology to make their own records for a start, which was a liberating thing, make your own films. I mean, it's extraordinarily sort of something I dreamed about when I was a kid. It got to the point, though, where because of the laptops, everybody thought they could make music and everybody thought they could master because they had this plug-in from whichever company it is, which is just a basic limiter, which just you put a fader down and it makes everything louder. You know, I mean, it's a brutal tool. It completely... I mean, it'd be interesting to listen to classical music with the over-limiting that sort of happens, because it would sound dreadful. And I can understand the reasons. They want you want your product to sound loud on the radio, so that it sticks out. I mean, I never got involved. Alan Wilder got involved in this with this loudness war a few years ago. He wrote a long piece about how this was an absurd situation. It wasn't taken into consideration the quality of the music, the function of the music. All it was my record's louder than yours. You know, is it better than that?
What we call a pissing contest.
It's exactly that. And
you would get things that were advertised as being remastered.
Yeah.
And all that meant was it's been compressed to fuck.
Possibly. I don't know. I think there are other movements afoot. Some of the recent remastering of things, like, I think Eno's records, actually a mate of mine who used to work at Mute, he's responsible for a lot of these reissues. They're doing this thing called half-speed mastering now, which is quite interesting. So it's almost giving you double the number of dots and ones. I think that's probably it. You know, it just allows you to I don't know, micromanage the sound a bit more. I don't know. But people swear that it sounds fantastic on vinyl, you know. But there's remastering to make things loud, and there's remastering because the original tapes, you know, maybe there was, you know, they were taking them off of vinyl and there's, you know, scratches and crackles and God knows what, and you can clean stuff up, you know, and that's restoration work. That's great, you know.
I feel like we're more or less over the loudness overcompressed thing, which is, thank God for that. I think 10 years ago this would have been a different conversation, but actually I think now
With the reoccurrence of vinyl being so popular again, I think that's it, because you've got to, you know, play by the rules.
Yeah,
you know, you don't play by the rules and it won't work. You know, it just won't play properly. You know, it's all.
Well, see, thank God for vinyl.
Well, yeah, we've got a little follow-up question on remastering from Kieran here, and he says, "Have we reached, or can we reach, a point where remastering is pointless because the original recording isn't limited due to any technical constraint and modifying it is purely for taste? Is that remastering is just something to put on the label to sell you a record?"
I don't know. I think a lot of it is the cash cow syndrome. You know, I think it's just, you know, how can we repackage this? But that keeps a lot of musicians alive, I suppose, you know.
There was a big... All of the Depeche albums were remastered and reissued, weren't they? About, was it 5 years ago, maybe?
They did 5.1.
Yeah, they've been remastered in 5.1 as well. And then there was HD audio versions, like DTS Master Audio, things like this.
They've just re-released some stuff as well, haven't they? Just redone the 12 inches.
12 inches have been redone, yes.
I'm on there, apparently.
You are on there, I believe, yes. Did you get a freebie?
No.
bless them.
No, I didn't. I wouldn't have requested. I wouldn't. I tell you, the only
you wouldn't have it in the house, Paul.
I lost a load of. I had a lot of obviously because I was in the record company at the time. I lost a load of 12 inches, limited 12 inches of Depeche, which don't really worry me, except that there was a couple that I really liked, the Adrian Sherwood ones, People Are People and Master and Servant. I think he did both of those.
Yeah, the On You Sound remixes.
Excellent, excellent stuff. I loved Adrian. I still like Adrian. You know, I think it's great what he's done.
Well, I've got a spare one of those. You can have it.
Oh, right. Oh, that's good.
Yeah, I do.
It still sounds good, doesn't it? He's a clever lad, that boy, yeah. Bless him.
This is a question from Rachel by email. She says, I'm obviously a huge Depeche Mode fan, but in the late 80s, early 90s, I followed Manchester music, and especially the In Spiral Carpets, with a passion. I was really surprised when they signed to Mute, which I saw as a predominantly electronic label. I know PK worked on some of their stuff. How did he find the mop-haired Northerners, and does he have any insight as to why Mute and the band did the deal? That is a strange marriage, isn't it?
Ask me a question on sport. I met them a few times, saw them at... I played the Reading Festival, I think. It was great. I think I saw them at that place in Kentish Town as well, just after they signed. Yeah, interesting band. They remind me of the Doors a lot.
They're organ-driven.
Yeah, and I mean, it's not, you know, a million miles away. I like the Doors. I sort of did a remix for them, except that it's not noted. It's called a Renegade, This Is How It Feels mix, but Renegade came in, put a loop down, and then walked away and said, "Oh, finish it for us, Paul."
I get the feeling this may have happened on more than one occasion where
No.
Well, I mean, he's far too modest to admit.
I could probably kick some people out of the studio. But yes, that was one. And me and Ken, the guy that was working with me at the time, we did this remix. But no, they were okay. And then I did a version of Paranoid, the Black Sabbath song, or something. I don't know, maybe I'm hallucinating here.
I hope they did.
No, I think they did. And then I did, I might have done a remix of that, and it was so bad that they didn't want it. And I used it on my solo album.
Did you just sort of drop out the bits that were more obviously there?
I think there was a lot of culling going on there.
Yeah, I'm sure your name's attached to at least one remix on Discogs, but that's not always a great guide because it is all crowdsourced, that information.
Yeah,
I've said to you before, I was asking you about your drumming and you were like, what drumming? Because you're listed as a drummer on something or other.
Well, that would be very bizarre.
Adam Weitzman, he wants to know, which of your productions or engineering jobs caused the most friction with the artist? What was the nature of the disagreement and how did it get resolved?
That's me telling tales, isn't it?
That's exactly what the listeners want.
That's quite difficult, really.
You must have had a tear-up with someone in the studio.
Yeah, no, I was very rude to an artist once. I think I had a cold at the time, and I had a hoodie on, and I was mixing with the hood up, which was completely unprofessional. How can you mix, you know, using your ears with a bloody woolen hood around your bloody head? No, it was bad. How did it finish up? Probably sounded dreadful, I think. But we remained friends, me and the particular person. I think we did. I did make one really bad mistake once, which is hilarious. I think it's funny because I like it when I make mistakes because you learn. I was working with Barry Adamson really, really early on, and we were working in, I think it was the Madness Studio just off Caledonian Road, sort of North London, and we were recording the drums for probably it was The Man with the Golden Arm or something like that. And as you know, I told you, I hate recording. Anyway, so I had to record the drums because we only had like an evening in session in there to record a few bits and bobs. So I mic'd it all up, and I'd seen people use, because I didn't really know what I was doing, right? I knew you put an SM58 on the snare drum, but I didn't really know what you put on the bass drum. And I saw this big Electro Voice microphone And I thought, yeah, that's the one. I've seen them use it. So I bung that in there. Bass drum sounded awful. Sounded like, you know, a biscuit tin or something like that. So I started EQing it on the desk. And then I think the tape bot might have come in and said, here, come here. I said, what? It's got a filter on the mic. You've just cut all the bass out of that mic.
And then, so you're recording. On the desk, you're trying to put the bass back in.
I didn't know. I'd never used the mic before. I didn't know there was a little switch on it to cut all the bass. So you take the bass out of a bass drum, it does sound like a biscuit tin. So, you do that. You make that mistake once, you don't make that mistake. And then another interesting one about the thing with Barry Adamson that I learned, which is very interesting, is that when we did a lot of the work on it, we'd be working, and we're working up before the Mute Studio. This is in the Rough Trade building. We go across the road to the pub and have a couple of drinks with the Rough Trade guys, you know, because it was great vibe going on there. Robin Guthrie used to go in there with Liz Fraser, you know, the Cocteau Twins used to drink in his pub. It was great, really good laugh. And then we come back and we carry on working till the early hours of the morning. And then when we went to another studio to work on it, all the stuff was like really bright. And I realised what happens is, when you drink alcohol, it actually cuts the high frequencies down on your ears. So you artificially accommodate for that by turning up the thing and then record it. So then when you come to mix it, last time you ever drink. I mean, I don't really drink anymore. I mean, you know.
So you're saying don't drink and mix.
Can't do it. I've got a theory about all the different drugs and how they relate to music, but I'll write about that one.
I've got another quick question here for you. What was your favourite part of the Strange Hour tour?
Because it looked very fun.
Oh, it was great fun. Yeah,
actually, you dancing and drinking.
I know about drink.
You drink. Well, it was a no alcohol beer.
No, drink. Yeah, no. There's bad stories about drinking. Depeche Mode. Is there? I blame Depeche Mode. There's a. Did you know there's a Depeche Mode bar in somewhere in the Baltic States? Which one? I can't remember which one it is.
Is it Riga?
Might be
in
Riga, or I don't know.
What do you mean a Depeche Mode bar?
There's a bar that is completely dedicated to Depeche Mode, and we were playing in this town, right?
Oh, did you? I hope you went to the bar.
Well, yeah, we got. Obviously, they knew that Alan was, you know, in town. Recoil were playing, so we got invited to go to this bar, and that was great. They were the really hospitable people, gave us a huge bottle of vodka, lots of, like, you know, energy drink stuff to mix with it. I was like, "Whoa, that's great." And I wake up at 6 o'clock in the morning on the bathroom floor and no idea, and with the worst hangover. So that was the worst moment. Drink is not really.
They did ask what your favourite part was, but you went straight to the worst.
There were some amazing things, amazing experiences. One of them was to play in the ballroom of Hansa in Berlin, where they'd recorded all these really, where Nick Cave had recorded Firstborn Is Dead, you know, the sound of that room. And there's some amazing recordings of Wire that Gareth Jones did in that particular room. And that, you know, they're fantastic. You know, they're sounds that I can see. You know, Flood always used to say, if you can't see the sound, don't record the sound. And, you know, in that room in Hansa, you know, you play one guitar note and you can see it. Unfortunately, for what we were doing, it was completely the wrong environment sonically, because it was bright. And it was. But the buzz of actually playing in that room was major. And the other one that I really got off on, we did big festival in Germany, the Wave Gothic Treffen, the big goth festival. We played there. That was hilarious. With Killing Joke, we're on half trust. What do I do?
They were on straight after you guys.
Yeah, they were headlining. We were just sort of...
You left it late to get to kind of go on tour and perform at that kind of level.
Yeah,
didn't
you? I know. Yeah, it was very odd. I started really early gigging. You know, I was gigging at 15 and doing weird gigs, but nothing like that. It was crazy.
You were telling me a story last time I saw you in Bexhill about Nine Inch Nails and the saxophone, but I think we got interrupted. So do you mind?
No, I'll give you that one.
Go on. Well, I played
it was funny, because I used to make all these weird noises on the saxophone, and funny enough, Daniel Miller was also a saxophone and harmonica player. You know, we've got a lot of, you know, things in common. He's just a much better record producer. But he was doing a remix for this Sheffield band called Hula, who'd actually, I think, supported Depeche on a bit of their tour once. It was great because Hula were quite an underground sort of experimental group, and for them to get the exposure of playing with Depeche was brilliant. And Daniel really liked them, and they were really, really nice guys. And so we were doing this remix of one of their tracks. And so it was at Blackwing, and he had his Synclavier set up. So it was before, it was quite early on, 86, 87, I suppose. They wanted a bit of saxophone in it. And Daniel said, "Hey, you play the saxophone, don't you?" I said, "Yeah, about as good as you, you know." And he said, "Well, yours, you can get hold of yours, bring it in." All right, so I played a few notes on the saxophone, put it into the Synclavier, and created this really cool saxophone solo. And that was it, got released. No, didn't think about it, you know. And then a few years later, Flood was supposed to work with Nine Inch Nails, but he got pulled off to do Depeche, I think, or something like that. So Trent was sort of floundering for someone to work with. And he knew I'd done some stuff with Flood and stuff like that. And he said, "Oh, yeah, all right, I'll get him to come over." So I got called out to Miami. I mean, I can remember him telling me, he said, "Have you ever been to Miami?" And I said, no, I've never been there." He said, "Okay." He said, "Watch the film Scarface."
Oh, God, no.
So I watched Scarface. I have to say, I felt a little bit out of my depth out there. The reason was, it wasn't just a really incredible studio in an incredible environment, but he was, at the time, he was using a big Pro Tools rig, which I'd never seen. I'd still been working on the small sound designer thing, and I hadn't seen that.
So this was early 90s?
Yeah, this was 91, 92, I think, 91. It was the recording of Happiness in Slavery. Right, that's what I basically did. I went out there for a week, and I recorded Happiness in Slavery and mixed bits and pieces, because by that time, he was really embracing Pro Tools, so he knew that he could mix a bit of it here, mix a bit of it there, and he'd bring it all together later and construct it. And I wasn't involved in that process, and I felt a little bit left out. I just felt... And also my attitude was a bit odd, you know. That we're different people to Americans, you know. You go, "What do you reckon of this?" And I go, "Yeah, it's all right. It sounds pretty good, you know." Whereas the reaction, it's great. Yeah. It's brilliant, you know. And it probably was, but just my natural phlegmatic approach wouldn't allow me to sort of get particularly excited about it. Anyway, lovely man. And we talked. He said, "One thing," I said, "I've got to say," he said, "your saxophone solo on the Hula album," he said, "blew my mind, man." And I said, "Oh, Trent, thanks. I really appreciate it. But I've got to come clean, man." I said, "It wasn't me. It was Daniel's Synclavier that did it all. I just honked a few notes, you know."
But that kind of, it shows that he knew his stuff as well, what he was listening to.
No, he's a real smart cookie. Anything, in fact, he was really disappointed not to... I think there were times, really, when he really wanted to sign to Mute. I think it would have fit. His cassette. Right, I had his demo cassette. Before he did anything else, John Fryer had a copy of it. I had a copy of it. Daniel had a copy of it. And Daniel gave it to us. He said, "Have a listen to this. See what you think. You know, see if you think it's any good." And I listened to it. I can really hear some... Yeah, this is excellent stuff. I think there was more to it than a simplistic... I think Daniel's attitude might have been at the time... It might have been complicated because some of the people that were involved with Trent were people that he'd had business with before or something. So it wasn't purely an artistic, aesthetic decision, you know. But he turned it down. He always said, "Oh, I've got this rib."
So, Paul, I've been on Discogs having a look at some of the projects you've worked on and some of the sort of prices and stuff, and how many items are currently for sale that you have a credit for. So how many items that you have a credit on do you think are currently for sale on Discogs? Bearing in mind, it could be more than one copy. So in total, how many items that you've got a credit for are up for sale on Discogs?
Well, I'm bargain basement. Bin bargain basement. No, I don't know. No idea. I look at Discogs, but it makes me sort of feel
it's
old.
It's going to be in the
thousands.
I think it might be in the tens of thousands.
There are currently 16,727 items that you are credited for sale. I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing, but that's a lot.
That's a lot, yeah.
That's a legacy, that is.
It is. I've looked up a couple of items that people are trying to sell that aren't cheap. So, Prolapse, the Italian flag. Did you work on this?
Good Lord. I was thinking about... Funny, I was thinking about them the other week.
Yeah, I hope you did.
possibly. No, I did a recording session with them.
Oh, okay.
I can remember going into a studio with them. I can remember... Actually, I can remember meeting them in the bar first.
Right.
To have a sort of business meeting with them. It was a bar in Greek Street. I remember that. I don't remember really anything about the group.
Well, let's assume that you did.
I may have done one track with them.
Well, someone's after £249 for that album.
Yeah, I haven't got a copy.
No. There's a Nine Inch Nails, a South African CD single of Broken.
Yeah, I don't think I'm not.
You probably haven't got one of those either, have you?
No, I don't know what he released. I think he could.
£340 they want for that.
Yeah.
One, I know you're going to kick yourself because you have a credited remix of Pleasure, Little Treasure by Depeche Mode, correct?
The Join, isn't it?
Yep.
Split, Join?
Join mix.
Join, yeah. All right. Yeah, yeah.
In France, this was actually released as the title single on promo only.
Yeah.
It sold in March 2016 for £509. For a 12-inch. Wow. Of stuff that you can get on other releases.
Yeah, no, that's remarkable. I remember the mix. That was me and John Fryer. It was John Fryer.
I think
me,
there was four or five names credited against him. You're definitely one of them.
No, we did, just John and I did a mix, which I think was called the Join Mix.
Yeah, I think it is the Join
and
Mix.
And that was us. We did that. And wherever it happened to it, I don't know. I know it was on the 12-inch, but...
Yeah, it was. But this in France, they promoted it as the A-side. And
weird.
Hence its value.
Yeah, that's very strange. Why would you want to do that?
We're nearly done. But what we want to know now is, obviously, after you left Mute, you obviously went on and done some solo stuff. You've done your own work. Where can people find you now? What can they buy now? I know you're rubbish at promoting yourself,
but you have to do it.
You're nearly as bad. Yeah, you've got nothing to chime in on this. The pair of you are rubbish at promoting yourselves. So please do. Where can people find you? I know you've got some lovely items for sale on your web shop.
Yeah. I can only remember the end of my nose. I'm not sure.
You are terrible at this.
I think it's Catwork Imprint.
That's the one, yes.
Which is Catwork Imprint is, I think, something that Olivia, my partner, and I sort of do. Well, I don't really do anything, and she does a lot.
You do, because I've bought a lovely box set with a CD, some beautiful prints inside it. It's absolutely amazing.
The problem was is that because when the ears started to descend, I decided that I really wanted to sort of still be quite creative. So I took up visual stuff. I used to do sort of visual drawings when I was a kid. I was hopeless at art. I came 97th equal out of 98 people in my year in art. So that puts me in my place. I was crap. But I like the idea because of the maths, and I like the idea of graphic words. So when I did that, I just did that and drawing lines, geometric lines. And then so I made this object, this box of A5 geometric patterns, and put it all in a box, put a CD of an album that I did a few years previous that had never been mastered. So I redid that album, got it mastered again. I think it's quite a violent little beast called Angle Terror. It's a little joke because I used to live in France, Angleterre, Angleterre. So, yeah, so we did that, and Olivia does releases her own music. But, yeah, catworkimprint.com, and I think it links direct to Bandcamp or something like that. The machinery of commerce is beyond my comprehension.
We'll put a link on Twitter and in the show notes. And your current live project.
We do. I do
play live. Yeah.
Oh, well, it's
don't come to my gigs.
No, we play very rarely. But I come from a improvisation discipline, and the things that I'm trying to do now are very much an improvisation thing, and I use a lap steel guitar as a sound source because I'm not a guitar player, and I've got some sort of springs and bits of metal that I hit with a violin bow and lots of guitar pedals. If I was in a younger frame of mind, one of the great technological advances over the last sort of 10-15 years is the rise of modular synthesizers, which feeds into a lot of my thing. Is that a lot of the music that we listen to that we call electronic music, I don't think it should be called electronic music myself. I think it should be called synthesizer music because it's generated by synthesizers, and that's just me being a snob. But what I would have loved in those days is a modular synthesizer, because as far as I'm concerned, when I was young, I had access to a synthesizer, the VCS3, which was an amazing sound generator. It didn't need a keyboard, right? It had complete fluidity of tonality, and for a non-musician, that was great. I didn't have to play notes, it was just sound that I was dealing with. And as soon as the big Japanese manufacturers, Yamaha and Roland, started putting keyboards attached to their synthesizers, I think they cut off a lot of the excitement and possibilities. I mean, they use the synthesizer as an emulator of real instruments, which is absurd. You know, I mean, it's fine. It's practical. You know, you can't always get a string orchestra in your front room. But synths are open-ended devices. And what's made me really happy in the last 10 years is the rise of the modular synth, which doesn't come with keyboards or anything like that. They're free, you know, plugging units against the next unit into the next unit. It's just so exciting now. And I couldn't go down that alleyway for a couple of reasons. One, it's quite expensive, and the other, the reason, because of my ears. And with synthetic sound, you don't know when you're going up really high. You can get spurious noise, and I can't deal with that. So most of the sounds that I produce now are mechanically generated. That's why I use the sort of guitar sort of bit and the springs. But then I plug them in through guitar pedals instead of plugging them in through modular synth, which, you know, most kids would do these days, and good luck to them.
I've got a final question for you, which is there's a film called Afterlife, a Japanese film, where it's a beautiful film, high concept idea, is that you, when you die, you go into this kind of limbo, which is a bit like almost a kind of college dorm or a sort of retreat. And you hang around there for a few days and you get a few guided interviews and you get help. The people that work there help you decide the memory from your life that you then take with you into the afterlife. So you're not conscious anymore, but your essence exists as a loop of this most cherished memory, right? So if you have that in the back of your mind,
right,
what's been a highlight of your musical career that if it was one thing to just keep you buzzing for eternity, does anything spring to mind?
Yeah, I'm going to be a bit oblique on this one. When Arsenal went up to Anfield...
Christ, right, thanks very much for joining us.
When Arsenal went up to Anfield all those years ago, and they had to win by 2 clear goals, right? I wasn't really following the football at that point. I was actually in Westbourne Grove, and I was in an Indian restaurant with 3 of the members of Wire, and the waiter said, "Oh, they've done it, they've done it," and it's when the you know, Michael Thomas got through a goal. And they won, right? So we did it. And I just went absolutely mental and bought everyone a very large drink. Cost me a bloody fortune that night. And Bruce and Graham, they're good drinkers, so, you know, it was a... But it worked. Yeah, that was great, man.
Really?
No, I'll try to be serious.
No, it's good.
In a musical thing, I think that the experiences I had with Recoil were just, like, too much, really. And then the pinnacle of that, I think, was... was being able to play at the Mute Weekend at the Roundhouse. For someone that had gone to gigs in the Roundhouse when they were a kid, you know, and seen some quite extraordinary things there. I didn't see the Doors there, but, you know, I'd seen quite a few concerts there. And then to actually be on stage, and it being in London with sort of lots of people and friends, family and stuff like that around was... Yeah, you don't get much better than that, you know.
Paul, it's been an absolute honour and a privilege to speak to you this afternoon. Thank you so, so much.
Good. I'm glad. I'm enjoying myself. And
We got through it. We did it.
I hope it's useful, yeah.
Thank you so much, guys.
Join us next time on We
Buy
Records.
We were debating about whether it's pronounced Knights' Ebb or Knits' Ebb.
I have always said Knights' Ebb, but I think you say Knits' Ebb.
I think I say Knits' Ebb.
I mean, it doesn't matter. The
thing is, I'm going to bow to his knowledge. Yeah.
But I'm probably sure that that's the way to say it, just because they were introduced to me.
That's what I'm thinking, is you actually worked with them. But
they're just... You know,
yeah, this won't take a lot. Then
if you're recording, I say just a pair of yobbos from Chelmsford.
Yeah.